including traditional nursery rhymes, a fairy tale by George MacDonald, and stories by Isaac Bashevis Singer, and writing only one book of his own, Higgledy Piggledy Pop, an expansion of the Samuel Goodrich rhyme with his dog Jenny, who had recently died, lovingly recreated in the starring role. Then, in 1970, he wrote and illustrated In the Night Kitchen. From the moment Dad first put it into my hands, I loved In the Night Kitchen without reservation. The story of Mickey's adventures as he falls out of bed, through the starry sky, into the mad nocturnal world of some friendly but committed bakers, bent on making him into a Mickey cake, until he escapes in a cake plane and goes for a swim in a massive bottle of milk before returning safely home to bed, fascinated me more deeply and in a different way from any book before, and quite possibly since. With its impressionistic style and dreamlike logic, it was the first that spoke to my non-rational mind, and the nameless power it held over me almost frightened me. It was elusive, slippery. I knew the story didn't make proper sense, and yet, despite this, I thought then, and because of this, I think now, it was endlessly compelling. Until In the Night Kitchen, I had been a purely, almost pathologically rational child, and my mother was always vigilant for signs of whimsy amongst her young. But Mickey opened up another part of my mind, where things could make sense despite not depending on causes, resulting in foreseeable consequences, or being wholly resolvable into words. I used to long to visit the night kitchen so much that I wondered whether the force of my desire might one day cause the comic book-style panels to burst their bounds, swell up around me like the cake batter did around Mickey, and swallow me whole. The thought made me ecstatic and anxious. I wanted to go but not leave my family behind. Luckily, it never happened. The panels held firm, time and space remained as they should, and I was never forced to make a difficult choice. In the Night Kitchen was born out of the moment Sendak looked at the rhymes he had selected for a Mother Goose collection he wanted to illustrate, and realised that they were all, one way or another, about food. Then he remembered an advertising slogan for the Sunshine Bakers that had annoyed him in childhood. "We bake while you sleep," it said. The young Sendak, who remained easily and richly infuriated all his life, thought this was the most sadistic thing in the world because all I wanted to do was stay up and watch. In the Night Kitchen, he once noted with satisfaction, was a sort of vendetta book. Not that there is any trace of hostility or mean-spiritedness in the book. It's a glorious experience, the book in which you can most feel the truth and effect of what Sendak called his dual apperception, the way in which, all his adult life, events were often heightened by the fact that he experienced them simultaneously as the child he had been would too. He still exists somewhere in me, in the most graphic, plastic, physical way. Into the kitchen are poured all Sendak's memories of the 1930s films that weren't King Kong. Everything from Busby Barclay extravaganzas to screwball comedies can be felt in the New York skyline composed of bags of flour, bottles, shakers, cartons of shortening, and in the madcap joy that suffuses everything. Plus, of course, there is that indefatigable trio of Laurel and Hardy-esque cooks, who were animals until Sendak happened across a rerun of the duo's old films while he was working. Of visiting the 1939 New York World's Fair. New York itself, he said, was always a magical land, forever glittering on the far side of the bridge from his home in Brooklyn. His love of comic books, whose layout, flat colours and bold contrasts, night kitchen mirrors, and the happier elements of his childhood. Instead of mutated relatives, there are authentic homely period details, like the Bakelite radio console, the Jenny written on it is another memorial to his beloved late dog, the fringed curtains, and the almost tangible warmth of the kitchen and the weirdly cosy domesticity of that reimagined skyline. Nothing, perhaps, illustrates the quintessence of Sendak more than the fact that, although he loved it, "I'm mad for it," he wrote in a letter to a friend, "and it's mad." He found the book that was most informed by happiness the most painful to produce. "It comes from the direct middle of me," he wrote in the same letter, "and it hurt like hell extracting it. Birth delivery-type pains." As with Wild Things, some critics poked their noses into the crib and recoiled at what they found there. One New York reviewer was perturbed by the sensuousness of Mickey's naked wallowing in dough and milk. Some, he said, might interpret it as a masturbatory fantasy. Okay, I guess some might. A German critic wondered whether the dough suit Mickey wears had connections, conscious or subconscious, to doughboys, as U.S. soldiers and Marines were commonly nicknamed during Sendak's youth, before GI became the popular term during the Second World War, and whether the oven was a reference to concentration camps. Others were simply concerned that, as one put it, being baked in a cake is more disturbing than any wild creature, or with the mere fact of Mickey's nudity, which resulted in several librarians adding hand-drawn nappies to our hero in their institution's copies. Yet parents take their children to museums where they see Roman statues with their dicks broken off, Sendak once mused. You'd think that would frighten them more. Like a lot of criticism, this all tended to reveal more about the critic than the subject supposedly under scrutiny. And of course the book sloughed off detractors and has done pretty well in the half-century since. It has sold millions of copies and allowed who knows how many young readers access to a different part of their brains. It has sent them the message that their dream worlds count too, and that not everything needs to make sense right now. What a tremendous gift to give a child. My own child won't give it the time of day, but I read it to him every month or so regardless. Not only is it a Caldecott book, it's Mummy's favourite. He should like it, and by God we will continue until he does. Still, I'm giving it a few more years before I make him face outside over there. According to Sendak, this was the final panel in a triptych reflecting a child's developing psyche. In the night kitchen was a representation of the toddler mind, thoughts tumbling through space and time unbounded by fear or rationality. Where the Wild Things Are gives us the 4 or 5-year-old who is just beginning to wake up to everything around him and wants to explore it, good or bad, for himself. The third book, Sendak promised a friend as he was writing it, would reverberate on triple levels. Outside over there is a singularly terrifying story about a baby kidnapped by goblins and being rescued, eventually, by the sister on whose babysitting watch he was stolen, an intimation of that moment at the age of about 10 or 11 when you begin to sense the horrors of adolescence starting to gather on the horizon. I'm not quite ready to talk about Outside Over There yet. I've never been so frightened. It works on the same visceral primeval level that all the most compelling and enduring fairy tales do. In Wild Things, Sendak is careful to walk the line between real fear and temporary insecurity. The Wild Things have scary yellow eyes, but soft, cuddly bodies. They roar and make a fuss, but Max tames them easily with a magic trick and quickly becomes their king. The rumpus is wild, ultimately under his control. In Outside Over There, that line is but a dot in the distance. The loss and guilt are real, jeopardy is real, the malevolence is real. The baby is restored to his family, but everything has shifted. The outside has been inside, and things can never be the same again. Maybe the family recovers someday, I hope so. This reader, so far, has not. Speaking of babies, it was around this time that Mum and Dad disappeared for 48 hours, exhorting me to be a good girl for Grandma and promising to bring me back a present. I assumed they meant my own copy of Spot the Dog. In fact, it turned out they meant a baby sister. The disruption to my well-ordered routine caused by nursery school was about to fade into complete insignificance. Ah well, at least Grandma and I enjoyed our time together. Chapter 2. To the Library. Nowadays, children are prepared for this kind of upheaval with specially written books on the subject. John Birmingham's There's Going to Be a Baby, perhaps, or Lauren Child's The New Small Person. To prepare the parents themselves, I recommend Kate Beaton's King Baby, a succinct yet comprehensive an explanation of the tyranny to which they are about to become subject as you could wish. I suspect, however, that even if they had been around in my day, and at least one was, in fact, Topsy and Tim's new brother came out in 1975, and in 1992 they had a new baby. Their parents should be studied by science. My parents would not have bought any of them. They were, after all, still only recently down from the north. Native parsimony and a disinclination to indulge in any form of southern softness, that is, attempting to alleviate any of the difficulties, sorrows, or infected sores that might be said to lie within life's natural exigencies with anything other than a Hail Mary, salt, or whiskey, would have comfortably outweighed their respect for books and learning. A baby arriving and shattering everyone's peace, quiet, and reading time was normal. Get on with it. So we did. But by God, she was noisy. Relief came when Dad started taking me with him on his weekly trips to the local library on Torridon Road. I had been there once before with nursery school, which was about 50 yards further down the road, but it had been awful. Everyone else ran riot, and, reactionary little fart that I was, it used to make me hot with shame and fury. Looking back, I wish someone had had the wit to crush a little baby Valium into my milk every morning. Everything could have been so much nicer with just a bit of the edge taken off. But the library, with Dad, a A man who spoke only when directly addressed and last initiated a conversation in 1960, never, and was unlikely to try and skid the length of the polished Victorian parquet floor, on a Saturday was wonderful. It had a beautiful dome, duck-egg blue on the inside, that I had no idea then was probably an homage to the British Library's famous reading room. And clustered in the sunlit area beneath it were a set of comfortable seats round a circular table covered in the day's newspapers, where adults could sit and get abreast of the day's events. It was cool in summer, and huge curved iron radiators kept the place gorgeously warm in winter. The place wasn't silent, rather it was full of what Jeanette Winterson, recalling her childhood haunt, Accrington Public Library, called a sense of energetic quiet. Dad and I would walk together through the heavy brass-handled doors with stained glass windows, nod silently at each other, and then peel off, him to the left and the grown-up books, me to the right and the children's. This was divided into two sections. In the one for older children, whom I longed to join, there was a long oak table with matching long back chairs, where they could sit and do homework. So industrious, so focused, so meaningful. I knew all that stuff with uniblocks and pipe cleaners was just pissing about, or read for pleasure with their big books propped up. It was still mostly hardbacks then, and no soft chairs. By the time I was taking my GCSEs, late 1980s economics and the revolution in publishing for teenagers combined to fill the place with carousels full of paperbacks in thick plastic covers, but for now everything was designed to endure. It added to the sense of security, of calm certainty that seemed to pervade the building. "Stop a while," the safe, solid brick walls seemed to say, like generations of a certain kind of seeker after a certain kind of pleasure have done before you. "Take your time. The books are here. You've got them. They've got you. What is it that you're looking for? An hour's escapism? A quick explanation of a DIY problem that's foxed you? A history lesson? A long investigation into some of the weightiest moral and philosophical issues that men have wrestled with down the ages? We've got them, and good radiators too." In the younger children's section, I knew perfect contentment. Light streamed in through more stained glass windows, bordered in amber, which for some reason used to fascinate me even more than the dome. And I would pick through the chunky wooden containers, appraising covers and titles, and putting aside possible candidates for taking home. When Dad had chosen his books, he would come and find me, and we would sift through the shortlist. Another Topsy and Tim, was I sure? All right. And Usborne's Understanding Dogs? Did I understand that this still didn't mean I was getting a dog? Okay. And we'd choose the final six. The booker had nothing on us. Library books have not, however, stuck in my mind. I think I, possibly unwittingly nudged by Dad, must have used them as filler. The ones he bought me, the ones I was able to keep and read and reread, and reread and reread, and were the ones I loved. Partly, of course, this was because, well, they were the ones my dad had bought me and that I was able to keep and reread and reread, and, which is to say, I loved them as objects, and the easy access led to familiarity and comfort and all the other things that make books important to children apart from content. And partly, of course, it was because, save the occasional Struwwelpeter-shaped misstep, everything he bought me was brilliant, and became more so every day, because I was starting to be able to decode them myself. My father had availed himself of a box of flashcards, and was teaching me, with his habitual patience, to read. I remember the cards vividly, lovely rounded black letters on bright white backgrounds out of a teal blue box. But to my everlasting regret, I don't remember any wondrous epiphanic moment when I was transformed from non-reader into reader. I know I could read before I went to school, but I don't remember a particular point at which the random scatterings of straight and slanted lines, circles and curves on the card or page began to resolve themselves into recognisable patterns, predictable arrangements, to become letters, then words, then sentences, then stories. I wish I could. Who doesn't want to be there when a miracle takes place? When a finite number of marks on a page begin to yield an infinite number of meanings and carry you away to an infinite number of lands. But I have racked my brains and my father's, and we cannot pinpoint anything. It must have been a gradual evolution, the end result of which has brought me so much joy over the years that it would be churlish to lament the loss of how it unfolded. But I do wish I could remember the transition. I remember later breakthroughs and lights dawning. Wordy, in the BBC TV series Look and Learn that we watched once a week at school, while I presume the teachers took a 20-minute break for fags and or gin as preferred, thrilled me with the news that magic E at the ends of words could transform them into entirely new words. Hat could become hate, cap could become cape, tap could become tape. The elegance and efficiency of such a rule pleased me no end, but I liked the quirks too. I came across George Bernard Shaw's famous respelling of fish as goaty in, of all places, Jackie magazine. It was in one of those crazy, did-you-know funky box-outs, and was entranced. It was a construction made to bolster the case for spelling reform, one of his pet causes. The GH is the GH from words like tough and cough, and so functions as the initial F sound. The O is the O from women. T, the sh sound in words like nation and so on. Also from Jackie, I learned that you shouldn't sleep using more than one pillow if you don't want a saggy neck when you grow up. This has proved to be untrue. As indeed, I have just learned during fact-checking the goaty derivation, is the attribution of it to George Bernard Shaw. It looks like it was actually first invented by a man called William Ollier Jr., a year before GBS was even born. You live, wrinkle and learn, eh? The silent K at the beginnings of knife and knee and the G in gnome caught my attention one day at school. Why were they there? Nobody knows, said the teacher. This again is not strictly true, as I would discover when I was doing my history of the English language term at university. Short version, they used to be pronounced. Over time, the pronunciations changed, but the spellings did not, so you have little bits of linguistic history preserved in etymological aspic all over the place. But one of my great personality flaws has always been to accept without question whatever anyone in a position of authority tells me. This earned me a reputation as a model pupil, when in fact I was nothing of the kind. I recognised myself perfectly years later, just after I finished my A-levels, in a footnote to Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon days. I learned that quietness could be used to personify not only goodness, but also intelligence and sensitivity, and so I silently earned a small reputation as a child of superior intellect, a little scholar, recalls one of the characters, while in fact I was smug and lethargic and dull as a mud turtle. That's me, I thought, and hoped it would be enough to get me into university. And it was. While Judith Kerr was writing Tiger and Mog, her son Matthew actually taught himself to read from Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat. I'm impressed with not just the talent and industry required by this feat, but the emotional robustness he must also have sported. I took The Cat in the Hat down from Lucy Donovan's bookcase and read, though the process at this point would probably be more accurately named, slowly, laboriously, but technically independently deciphered, it. I thought I had hated Baba. No. It turned out I'd merely disliked Baba. But The Cat in the Hat? That I hated. I hate it still. Cat in the Hate, I call it. And a tip of the hat to you, Magic E. Theodore Geisel, the real name of Dr. Seuss, was approached by publisher William Spaulding, who had read a famous book at the time called Why Johnny Can't Read, which criticised the look-say method of teaching reading, what we would call whole-word recognition, and called for a return to the use of phonics, and noted the growing wider dissatisfaction with the quality of reading material for young children, epitomised by the Dick and Jane books, which, like the UK's later Peter and Jane books from Ladybird, dominated the market and were boring children to tears. As Game of Thrones writer George R.R. Martin put it once in an interview, Dick and Jane and their little sister Sally and their dog Spot were the dullest family in the history of Earth. Oh boy, they were boring. You know, the stories were stupid, even for a first or second grader. That couldn't convince me to keep reading. So, legend has it, Spaulding challenged Geisel to write me a story that first graders can't put down, to produce the anti-Dick and Jane adventure, but still using only words drawn from the list of a few hundred that children of that age were expected to know. Geisel noted that the first pair of words to rhyme in the list were cat and hat. Some weeks later, he had the tale Two Children Alone and Slightly Bored at Home, being visited by the rule-breaking, chaos-loving, lanky feline in the stripy chapeau, and all hell breaking loose. The child who regarded a tiger who came to tea not as a glorious intimation of the wealth of possibilities offered by the world and the imagination, but a threat to suburban propriety, and who exhorted freedom-seeking elephants to stay caged for their own safety, naturally rejected the hatted cat entirely. He was malevolent, the anarchy was awful, the danger to life and limb was palpable, I was firmly on the side of the fish. I came to assume over time, as my awareness of the critical and personal esteem in which Dr. Seuss's most famous and enduring creation is held, that my feline animus must just have been childish prejudice. So I bought the damn thing a few years ago and sat down to read it with Alexander. Do you know what? I was right the first time. That cat is horrible. I would happily shoot Thing One and Thing Two, and the fish and I are more simpatico than ever. Alexander didn't like it either. Now, obviously, I work on the principle of working towards the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people, and I'm glad it freed a generation of children from the tyranny of traditional primers. But give me Dick or Peter and his concomitant Jane any day. The Cat in the Hat can take his anapestic anarchy and bugger off. That said, I bought Did I Ever Tell You How Lucky You Are at the same time, which Geisel wrote in 1956. It was published then in Red Book magazine and as a children's book in 1973, and fell immediately, wholly and irrevocably in love with this brilliantly sustained monologue by a wise old man sitting on top of a cactus and cheering up a child with a riotous procession of examples of how much worse off he could be. He could be a horch-horcher, bee-watcher-watcher, or a poor Herbie Hart who has made the mistake of taking his thrombibulator apart, or Mr. Potter, the T-crosser and I-dotter at an I&T factory out in Van Nuys. Although, truth be told, I would quite like to have Mr. Potter's job. It's a bravura display of wild and wonderful invention, and the only book I actively enjoy reading aloud. In it, I find all the joy and generosity that other people seem to find in The Cat in the Hat. I allow it as a bedtime book, even though it goes on forever, because it's such an unassailable treat. How lucky am I? Blake Birmingham Scarry Briggs. I was now coming up for five, and my sister was nearly two and much improved. I liked her fluffy hair, enormous eyes, so sweetly babyish until you looked closer and saw the fierce roving intelligence that would in a few years' time settle on the BBC microcomputer Dad brought home from his office and be channeled into building Catford's answer to Skynet. And above all, the fact that she now stopped screaming for whole minutes at a time. You could also push her sideways on the sofa and she would slowly topple over without changing position, like Del Boy falling through the bar. Look, even bookworms occasionally had to make their own entertainment, okay? Mum had gone back to work within 10 minutes of giving birth. Stitch me up, let's get on. And Dad had just started a new job teaching at a drama school in Sidcup. One day he brought home a book by an author and illustrator he had never heard of, but who was on sale everywhere near the school because it was the creation of someone who had grown up nearby. His name was Quentin Blake. Today, of course, Sir Quentin, as he is now, is virtually synonymous with Roald Dahl and has been ever since they first united in perfect harmony on The Enormous Crocodile in 1978. But for me, he was the man who created Patrick, a book about a man whose violin music floods everything with colour. It was born at the end of the 1960s out of Blake's frustration with the fact that he was at that point seen as a black-and-white illustrator, so he wrote a story that would give himself free polychromatic reign at last. And, above all, the stories of Lester and his boon companions, Otto, flap-eared Lorna, always on roller skates, and a variety of other idiosyncratic and captivating characters who live in a land where everything you need, including general hardware, grows on trees. Who else but Blake would conjure up the string thing? What does it look like? It looks like a string thing. Brown, potatoey blob, not to be confused with the potato animal, you understand, whose low singing is often the only way you can distinguish it from a non-animal potato, with a thin black line running out of it, and make you love it. Blake drew his first cartoons on the backs of his school exercise books, and was selling them to Punch before he had left sixth form. After university and national service, he was soon producing covers for The Spectator, but realised that what he really wanted to be was an illustrator of children's books. So he asked a friend of his, John Yeoman, if he would write a book that Blake could illustrate. Yeoman could, and did. It was called A Drink of Water, and they have collaborated many times since. Mouse Trouble, about mice that save a cat brought in by the owner of the mill in which they live from being drowned because he has pleasingly little interest in catching any of them, is this household's current favourite, though the household has had to reach an understanding that it is a little too long to qualify as a bedtime book. Downstairs only. Mummy would like to get to her dinner before midnight. Blake's spiky kinetic line is always unmistakable. It united disparate books wherever you came across them as easily as Shirley Hughes's did. His drawing's sense of movement, the energy alone makes them compelling. Many illustrators draw parallels between their work and theatre or film, but most of them liken it to set design or, at the outside, direction. It's telling, perhaps, that when he was interviewed by the principal of Rose Bruford College of Speech and Drama in his native Sidcup at an event celebrating his status as a local lad made good, Blake likened his work more to the most dynamic element, acting. And like an actor, he thinks himself into the part of the child reader. I never think of myself as an adult and ask, what do they want, he says. It's more a feeling of being a child with them. His actors, conveying as much in two dimensions as their fleshly counterparts do in three, are probably the dominant images of any young modern reader's childhood. As well as being hugely attractive in their own right, so colourful, full of life, fun and happiness, They look completely spontaneous and chime with a child's sense of immediacy. I like to work in a lot of rapid bursts with much sitting about in between, he says. The results are exactly the drawings you want when you live, as children do, in an eternal present. He retains all his original instincts and early experience as a cartoonist who has deadlines to meet and topical events to distill, but which have become married to a talent for narrative exploration. He still distills characters, the twit's supreme awfulness conveyed as much by the exact degree of their squints and pop-eyedness as by Dahl's words or the close-up view of the rotting food bits in Mr. T's beard. But everywhere else he adds detail that expands the text and leaves books pulsing with vitality. And so his work propels you helter-skelter through the book, the focal point frequently a little ahead of the drawing, as Douglas Martin puts it in his essay on Blake in The Telling Line, until you fall exhausted and exhilarated across the finishing tape. I've often wondered whether he must be a pathological optimist to produce such endlessly witty, cheerful, energetic drawings. I was almost relieved when I read an interview with him in which he said, "I can draw much more cheerfully than I feel." My other great love brought home by Dad was John Birmingham. He had become famous with his first book, Borka, The Adventures of a Goose with No Feathers, which won the 1963 Kate Greenaway Medal, but it was his two Shirley books that captivated me. In Come Away from the Water, Shirley, her parents unfold their deck chairs and drab lives in equally drab line and wash on the left-hand side of each spread, while our heroine stands at the shoreline and lets her imagination carry her off into colourful adventures on the right. In Time to Get Out of the Bath, Shirley, she goes on medieval quests within the confines of the tub. Both books juxtapose imagination and reality without comment. The contradiction stands like a riddle, waiting for the moment the child reader is ready to solve it. Elaine Moss once carried out an experiment with Come Away from the Water, Shirley, reading it to different groups of children between the ages of 5 and 11. She found that roughly the same proportion of listeners in each age group realized, or didn't realize, that Shirley was off in her imagination while her parents remained obliviously rooted in reality on the beach. I don't remember my own eureka moment, only the delight of being in on the joke, but one librarian remembers being there the moment light dawned for one little boy. "Her think," he suddenly exclaimed, "is on that side." But at whatever age that realization dawns, when it does, it's like being let in on one of the great secrets of the universe, which, I suppose, you are. A door of perception opens. Dude, a door of perception opens into your own perceptions. You can see that your mind can respond to reality, or it can escape from it, engage or ignore. Your thoughts can bear no relation to what other people are thinking about, or to what other people think you're thinking about. You contain multitudes. And so, bizarrely, bogglingly, terrifyingly, and yet thrillingly, does everyone around you. Except those silly, prosaic parents of yours and Shirley's, obviously. Imagine. In similar fashion, Birmingham also opened up the eternal horrors and pleasures of the thought experiment to me, via his Would You Rather. The book's premise is simple. Make a choice. Would you rather be crushed by a snake, swallowed by a fish, eaten by a crocodile, or sat on by a rhinoceros? Fish. Would you rather jump in the nettles for £5? Swallow a dead frog for £20, or stay all night in a creepy house for £50. Nettles. But why? And why not? And why does the person reading it to you, or with you, disagree? Why do they fear the fish but you fear the snake? Why do they envisage one set of consequences and you see entirely another? Oh, it is a book of fathomless depth and endless wonders, to be debated long into the night with your ever-patient father. It was one of the few books I kept begging Dad to read to me again long after I could read it for myself, and the only one he, my sister in a few years' time, and I would ever read together. It was so good that even Mum got involved occasionally, though to be honest, she never got wholly into the swing of teasing apart intricate philosophical conundra. "Easy," she'd exclaim. "You'd stay in the creepy house, of course. Anyone would. There's no such thing as ghosts." For light relief, there was Richard Scarry, with his riotous action and character-packed tales of life in industrious small American towns, who managed to stay pleasingly old-fashioned and homely, despite their plethora of power plants, logging activities, paper mills, road building, train stations, multiple car pile-ups, renegade gorillas, and much, much more. Scarry's books last you as a reader a pleasingly long time. In your earliest days, the pictures are more than enough. There are hundreds to pore over in his crammed pages, thousands of details to absorb. Finding gold bugs somewhere within every spread of Richard Scarry's cars, trucks and things that go is, I assure you, a full afternoon's work alone. Later, you can begin to puzzle out the words. The labels first, maybe, then the speech, then eventually the longer captions carrying the story itself underneath. If you are wired like me, you will stop there. If you are wired like my sister, you will move on to understanding the diagram showing how electricity and so on is made, graduate immediately to David Macaulay's How Things Work, and be able to rebuild society in the event of an apocalyptic crisis by the time you start school. Later on, of course, if you have your own kids, you will start breaking the books down into their component parts once more so that you can build the stories anew with them. Look, there's Goldbug. Scarry's books depict a very 1950s world, so he has tweaked them over the years and revised them relatively extensively in the early 1990s to bring them up to date and address evolving concerns about gender roles and so on. Now, father rabbits as well as mothers cook for their families, lady bears drive steamrollers, and the cat labelled Beautiful Screaming Lady, being rescued by a brave hero in one of Busy Town's many conflagrations, is a more prosaic but accurate cat in danger, being saved by a firefighter. I regret the loss of whimsy, but times change, and what we lose in gently wry humour we gain in the next generation growing up to be not quite so rigidly socio-sexually codified and casually racist as the one before, I guess. Good work, lowly worm and pals. Now, if you could just take out that equally 1950s sense of optimism and can-do that also infuses Scarry's anthropomorphic world, and replace it with a more cautious, fearful sense that everything is about to fall apart, you will have a true reflection of the modern age, and our children need not be perplexed or unsettled by the cheery faces on every page. Or, of course, they can simply turn to Raymond Briggs, the man that gave the world fungus, conscientious but dispirited bogeyman, a snowman that comes thrillingly alive but eventually melts away despite the magic, and a grumpy Father Christmas. They all made a terrible kind of sense. Who said bogeymen had to be happy in their work? Snowmen melt. That is their nature, alive or not. And why on earth, when he thought about it, wouldn't Father Christmas be grumpy? All that work crammed into such an absurdly short space of time. The loneliness of the rest of the year, never able to share your secrets or talk about your work with others. And the awful expectation of cheerfulness. Briggs's sensibility was once described as Flip Larkin meets Hogarth, and it was one I warmed to immediately. It didn't exactly introduce me to the concept of misanthropy, but it gave form to the inchoate stirring in my own breast, an embryonic feeling that other people were not a welcome addition to life, but an energy-sapping intrusion into it. I count myself very lucky to have got Raymond Briggs under my belt so young. I was about to start school. This is not a good time for a misanthropic introvert bookworm. To deal with it, I would need all the help from similarly tortured souls I could get. School. My mother took me down to the big Victorian building, 10 minutes walk from home, 200 yards or so away from the library, and built the year after it, finishing off the estate nicely, on my first day. 33 of us were decanted into a single separate classroom in the playground. It was a perfectly square, squat building with sides made almost entirely of huge glass windows, which had then been spread with a thin layer of concrete to well over head height, an early health and safety measure, I presume. I like to imagine a world-weary teacher coming down with a mug of tea from the staff room just as the architect finished his proud first circuit round the completed cube and saying to him, "Floor-to-ceiling plate glass, housing 3 dozen mixed infants. Nice going, you modernist tit." I waved my mother off in relatively sanguine mood. I could read. I was keen to learn to write and willing to have a crack at sums if need be. What else was there? At 3:30, Mum picked me up. I staggered brokenly down the steps. What, she asked with interest, if not concern, was the matter? It was hard to put into words, but the writer Florence King managed it in her scabrous, hilarious autobiography, Confessions of a Failed Southern Lady. Until I began school, she wrote, I hadn't realised I was a child. I thought I was just short. It was as new and terrible a revelation to me as it had been to her. My parents treated me and my sister as miniature adults, which is to say, they let us be ourselves. Not in a hippie way. I think my mother once bought some cheesecloth, but in all other respects the age of Aquarius passed my parents by. But in the old-fashioned way, born more of polite intergenerational disinterest than anything else. As a family, we practiced a sort of non-rugged individualism. We were thoroughly schooled in manners, ignored if we cried, absent free-flowing wounds or splintered bones, intimidated into a healthy respect for our elders, and if you wanted to express yourself via any medium other than grammatically sound conversation held at a reasonable volume, you were best advised to try it elsewhere. They didn't see it as their job to intrude much on our actual selves or require us to pretend to be anything we were not. My sister is energetic, practical, gregarious, a born manager of others, and as a child, at least before the computer arrived, most liked to spend her time building Lego behind the sofa, bringing in friends for company or quasi-military campaigns to annex the rest of the sitting room, or whenever there was a tricky engineering problem with the scale model of Porton Down she was building that she couldn't solve alone. She was left, largely, to get on with that. I was bookish, inert, unsociable, and could generally be found wherever you'd seen me 8 hours ago. And I was left largely to get on with that. Sure, people wanted you to be tidier, not drop crumbs, be more sensible about where you plonked yourself to read for 8 hours, and would occasionally push you outside for some sunshine before your bones started to soften and that sort of thing. But these were just superficial adjustments to extrinsic house rules. You were not being asked for radical personality change. You could be yourself. At school and out in the wider world, things were different. Over the next 6 months in that cuboid, concreted pressure cooker, I would discover that much, in fact, was expected of little girls. They should be polite, charming and lively, interested in everyone and everything and not afraid to show it. And from a grotesquely early age, coquettish. If you were naturally bookish and showing early signs of being good at exams, you had to compensate for that by aping all the feminine graces you could even more intensely. As the novelist Henry Adams told his studious wife Marion, whom he felt didn't own enough gowns, those who study Greek must take care of their dress. At 5, I was largely studying the difference between upper and lowercase letters, but in my spare moments I was already having to contemplate tearing down my entire personality and starting again from scratch. It seemed like a lot of work, and I'm absolutely sure that Raymond Briggs's Father Christmas and Fungus the Bogeyman both aided me in my deliberations in the weeks, months and years to come, the outcome of which was that I decided I wouldn't fucking bother. Passive resistance became my watchword. I would nod and say, yes, I had seen a television program, liked someone's shoes, was looking forward to the infant school disco, fancied the fanciable boy, but saw what others saw in the less fanciable one, and then discreetly withdraw from the conversation before anyone could press me for details. I would memorize phrases people used about sports or personalities or pop songs I knew nothing about, so that I could drop them in at apposite moments to maintain a protective veneer of common knowledge. It was tiring, but not as tiring as either actively resisting everyone's urgings to giggle and skip and run about and grow my hair and tilt my head and laugh and all the endless rest of it, and not nearly as tiring as giving in and actually doing it. This is an important step in the evolution of the bookworm. Until then, you've just been a soft, larval mass of love for books and reading. Now, through repeated exposure to other people, you begin to acquire a carapace that will both protect and alienate you from them. I don't say a cocoon or chrysalis. That would, as you already know from your Eric Carle, imply that there's going to be a process of magnificent transformation. There isn't. There's just going to be more of the same. It's bookworm, not book butterfly. This is your life now. It's just your good or bad luck that this is the only way you're ever going to be happy. You will know the true bookworm, by the way, by its response to another of Raymond Briggs's most famous books, When the Wind Blows, the story of retired Hilda and Jim Bloggs living through a nuclear attack on Britain and gradually succumbing to radiation sickness afterwards. The greater part of the bookworm's young mind will, of course, be consumed by the horrors therein and need to talk it through many times with whichever parent is best suited to the task. I knew where I should head. My dad was good for good things. But nuclear war? That was Mum's department. I expressed concern that a door propped up against a wall might not be adequate protection against radioactive fallout. If I put it up, she replied, it will be. I was wholly reassured. But part of the bookworm's brain, the same part that will read Papillon 20 years later and not really get it because it doesn't immediately understand that solitary confinement is meant to be a punishment, will quietly consider that, given enough time to make proper arrangements for her own survival, a world suddenly purged via one sky-melting blast of the scourge of humanity has much to recommend it, and face the likelihood of nuclear holocaust within its lifetime with no little interest and almost perfect equanimity. As long as there are enough books in the bunker, I could have lined a small shelter with mine already. I had just been given my very own bookcase to house them all. I have it still. It's in my study. White, about 4 feet tall by 3.5 feet wide, with 4 shelves of increasing depth as you go down, fortifying in every sense. How bad can it really be? Chapter 3. Now I am 6. Plop. I have envied my sister many things over the years. At this point, it was her cuteness, so much greater than my own. Partly I knew this was simply because she was younger, and that much I was willing to resign myself to. I must have had my moment in the sun at the same age, I figured, even if it was one too early to remember. But she also had a lovely open face and fizzing energy that I lacked, and knew I would always lack, that drew people already smiling towards her. This I found harder to reconcile myself to. I found a certain solace in the My Naughty Little Sister books by Dorothy Edwards. These are written for readers of about 6 or 7, just about the time younger siblings are really starting to encroach on your citadel, from the point of view of a responsible, long-suffering, but essentially kind and generous-spirited older sister who recounts the crimes and misdemeanours of her, yes, you've guessed it, naughty but equally good-hearted little sister and her occasional accomplice, Bad Harry, a child with a capacity for consuming stolen trifle that almost equals the little sister's own. The story's settings are quaintly endearing now. Written more than 50 years ago, they're set in a world of taffy pulling, bonfire puddings, doctors with Gladstone bags, party frocks that must be kept too clean for fun, and red ink bottles for faking chickenpox spots. All illustrated by the ever-wonderful Shirley Hughes's warm, untidy drawings. But the themes are timeless. The charms and frustrations of having a younger child whose imagination periodically runs away with her and must be explained to the neighbours. Yes, she picked your flowers, but only because tulips make such very good pretend cups for pretend tea when you are a pretend lady out shopping in the lane. The fascination with a being who does not yet comprehend consequences, and the love for the incorrigible little bugger that infuses all. My own sister wasn't naughty, though, dear God, she liked her own way. But Edwards's tale showed me that you simply couldn't fight nature. Older and quieter was always going to lose to younger and livelier, even when the latter was bent on destruction. The older sister was telling the story, and even then the younger was the star of the show. Such was the natural order of things. It helped, in an odd and roundabout way, but it helped. Still, sibling rivalry can come rushing back to you at odd, unguarded moments. A few years ago, I mentioned to my sister that I was planning to visit Penshurst Place in Kent for the first time. "Oh, yes," she said. "Dad and I went there once when I was little." "Without me," I said, ever alert to potential acts of favouritism and not about to let an intervening 3 decades dampen my outrage. "Yes, of course," she said, looking baffled. "We used to go every weekend." "To Penshurst Place," I said, equally baffled in my turn. My sister is not known for a love of either Philip Sidney, Renaissance poetry, or Elizabethan architecture. She likes computers, dogs, and Mythbusters on the Discovery Channel. "No, turd," she said. She has never quite shown me the full measure of respect I feel is due to elder sisters. "Different places, on the Mangan Magical Mystery Tour." It transpired that she and Dad used to set off in the car every Saturday and take it in turns to choose whether to go left or right at each junction and see where they ended up. "And where was I?" I asked. "Where do you think you were?" she said. "You were at home, reading. We told you we were going every time and you never broke eye contact with your stupid books. Sometimes you'd wave goodbye as you turned a page." I have racked my brains, but I truly do not remember them going. I would question her veracity, but A, I'm scared of her, and B, there's no point. They surely went, and I as surely didn't notice. Such was the whole of a book back then. The intensity of childhood reading, the instant and complete absorption in a book, a good book, a bad book, any kind of book, is something I would give much to recapture. And it all began with Plop. He was the hero of the very first book I remember being wrenched out of my hands by a bellowing mother as she marched me towards a plate of burnt fish fingers and chips. The Owl Who Was Afraid of the Dark by Jill Tomlinson. It had been published only about 10 years earlier, in 1968, but it hasn't been out of print since, and is now, God, I am so old, an acknowledged classic for young readers. Modern folk can get it in heavily illustrated picture book, audio and abridged board book form, as well as the original paperback that was my delight. Tomlinson's book is the story of a baby barn owl called Plop, and have you ever come across a more perfectly appropriate name for a character? What else could a fat and fluffy baby owl with a beautiful heart-shaped ruff, enormous round eyes, and very knackety knees possibly be called? Who suffers from the eponymous affliction? In vain does his mother explain to him that he is a night bird. "Nocturnal," said Dad, who, though no longer storyteller-in-chief, maintained his vital role of explicator and synonym supplier. He would be constructively dismissed the day I found out what a thesaurus was. I still feel bad about that. Anyway, Plop wants to be a daybird. You are what you are, says Mrs. Barnell firmly. Yes, I know, agrees Plop, and what I are is afraid of the dark. I read this now to my son and it makes me howl with laughter, though I don't remember laughing then. Perhaps reading was too serious a business still, or perhaps I just didn't know enough about grammar to appreciate the joke. But I loved it all, nevertheless. In the course of 7 beguiling chapters, including Dark is Exciting, in which Plop sees fireworks for the first time, Dark is Necessary, where he meets a little girl who explains to him about Father Christmas, and Dark is Wonderful, when he meets an astronomer who identifies the stars for him, Plop gradually loses his fear and eventually comes to feel that dark is super. I was careful of my books. I was careful of everything. Mud turtles are like that. But that late 1970s copy of Plop's Adventures is undeniably battered. It became a fiercely private possession, and reading and rereading and rereading and rereading, an intensely personal experience. It was with The Owl Who Was Afraid of the Dark that I truly fell in love with the act of reading itself. I had adored being read to, enjoyed the stories, but the ability to take down a book off a shelf, open it up and translate it into words and sounds and pictures in my head, to start that film rolling all by myself and keep it going as long as I pleased, or at least until the next meal, bedtime or other idiotically unavoidable marker of time's relentless passage in the real world was announced, well, that was happiness of a different order. When I was reading, the outside world fell away completely, and it required the application of physical force to break my concentration. Though my mother, as one for whom fiction could never assume any kind of reality, never believed me, any more than she would believe in the years to come that her children were hungry, thirsty, or tired outside the appointed hours, I never deliberately ignored her calls to come to lunch or dinner or to start cleaning my teeth and get ready for bed. Like every bookworm before and since, I simply and genuinely didn't hear them. Whenever I was with a book, on the sofa, on my bed, on the loo, in the back seat of the car, I was always utterly elsewhere. Adults tend to forget, or perhaps never appreciated in the first place if lifelong non-readers themselves, what a vital part of the process rereading is for children. As adults, rereading seems like backtracking at best, self-indulgence at worst. Free time is such a scarce resource that we feel we should be using it only on new things. But for children, rereading is absolutely necessary. The act of reading itself is still new. A lot of energy is still going into not-so-simple decoding of words and the assimilation of meaning. Only then do you get to enjoy the plot, to begin to get lost in the story. And only after you're familiar with the plot are you free to enjoy, mull over, break down and digest all the rest. The beauty of a book is that it remains the same for as long as you need it. It's like being able to ask a teacher or a parent to repeat again and again some piece of information or point of fact you haven't understood, with the absolute security of knowing that he, she will do so indefinitely. You can't wear out a book's patience. And for a child, there is so much information in a book, so much work to be done within and without. You can identify with the main or peripheral character or parts of them all. You can enjoy the vicarious satisfaction of their adventures and rewards. You also have a role to play as interested onlooker, able to observe and evaluate participants' reactions to events and to each other with a greater detachment and consequent clarity sometimes than they can. You are learning about people, about relationships, about the variety of responses available to them, and in many more situations and circumstances, and at a much faster clip than one single real life permits. Each book is a world entire. You're going to have to take more than one pass at it. What you lose in suspense and excitement on rereading is counterbalanced by a greater depth of knowledge and an almost tangibly increasing mastery over the world. I was not frightened of the dark like Plop, but now I knew that some people could be. This was useful. I could be more sympathetic to people who suffered from the same affliction in the real world, and I could also, dimly and in a more complicated way, understand why some people might find it difficult to understand fears I had that they did not share. The philosopher and psychologist Riccardo Manzotti describes the process of reading and rereading as creating both locks and the keys with which to open them. It shows you an area of life you didn't even know was there and almost simultaneously starts to give you the tools with which to decipher it. There is hope for a man who has never read Mallory or Boswell or Tristram Shandy or Shakespeare's sonnets, C.S. Lewis once wrote. But what can you do with a man who says he has read them, meaning he has read them once and thinks this settles the matter? Exactly. The more you read, the more locks and keys you have. Rereading keeps you oiled and working smoothly. The better to let you access yourself and others for the rest of your life. I don't mean to place too much of a burden on Plop's tiny feathered shoulders, but if we were able someday to trace back a person's development of kindness, tolerance or compassion, or their willingness to entertain an alternative point of view or lifestyle or decision, how much of it all wouldn't come back to a myriad of tiny moments, such as learning that others can be afraid of the dark? In 1932, the French scholar and admirable optimist Paul Hazard wrote a book called Les Livres, les Enfants et les Hommes, in which he reckoned children would learn about each other through books and that this would eventually end conflict. So far, at least, it hasn't quite worked out like that, but the point he was making, that as soon as you begin to read, you begin to cultivate empathy, if only at first in the very smallest of ways, stands. This is why it slightly frustrates me that my son has never really had a favourite book. Even when he was very young and we were reading picture books to him, he never demanded the same one night after night, and he hasn't become impassioned about any others since. I imagine his mind littered with half-formed locks and bent, useless keys. There is hope for a boy who has never read The Gruffalo or Come Away from the Water, surely, but what can you do with one who has listened to them a handful of times and then buggered off to his Tonka trucks and thinks that settles the matter? Ah, well. We watch, keep trying new books, and wait. Teddy Robinson and Mildred Hubble. My dad was still working long hours during the week, and in recompense had started coming home with a new book for 5-year-old me every Friday. I'm sure he brought Emily something too. A ratchet spanner set or a carburettor perhaps, or maybe a jar of depleted uranium depending on the project she was working on behind the sofa at the time. I don't know, I was reading. Bliss it was to be alive every Saturday morning when I would come down and find a shiny, pristine paperback on the breakfast table by my cereal bowl. Thus was Plop joined on his shelf by several biographical volumes about the life of a nice, big, comfortable teddy bear with light brown fur and kind brown eyes, owned by a little girl called Deborah and named Teddy Robinson. When I picked them up a year ago to read to Alexander, I remembered them simply as delightfully domestic micro-adventures about a bear who accompanies his owner on a bus, goes with her to hospital, or accidentally stays out all night in the garden that managed to both thrill and soothe me. Turns out that in later life, like Plop, Teddy R is hilarious too. In one story, he performs magic for an audience that includes a noisy, toy-spotted dog who has seen it all before. "The marble's gone under the other bowl, the white one. That's not a new trick," I recounted to Alexander one evening. Teddy Robinson waited, looking mysterious and important. Deborah lifted up the white bowl. There was nothing there. Then she lifted up the red bowl. There was the marble. "You see," said Teddy Robinson, "it is a new trick." I paused. "It's the lack of exclamation point at the end there that gives it its true genius," I explained. "Stop talking. More story," Alexander instructed succinctly. "Fair enough," I said, turning back to Teddy Robinson Goes to the Fair. "But 30 years from now, this stuff is going to slay you." I don't wish to brag, but I have met Teddy Robinson. Yeah, the real one. And Deborah. She's now in her mid-60s and living in the same house in Hampstead as she did as a child, and in which her mother set the books. She showed me the original drawings for the books and some of the unused ones. I actually held unseen bits of Teddy Robinson's life in my hands. I lifted his purple dress, too, out of his little suitcase, and then I had to excuse myself and nipped the loo for a small cry. Yes, I are a fool. More Fridays passed and more delights accumulated on my top shelf. Amongst them was a purple-covered volume with a black silhouette of a girl with a broomstick, pointy hat and cauldron at the front. She was the worst witch. Long before J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter and Hogwarts, there was Jill Murphy, Mildred Hubble and Miss Cackle's Academy. Murphy was 15 when she first sketched the gangling girl whose adventures she would still be writing half a century later. She wrote the first story to accompany her drawings 3 years after that, employing her experiences of attending an Ursuline convent, whose fearsome teacher nuns no more enjoyed or embraced their artistic scatty pupil than Miss Hardbroom does scatty Mildred, and it was published in 1974 by a new publishing company, Allison and Busby. Several older outfits had rejected it on the grounds that children would be frightened by the idea of a school for witches. Its first print run sold out within 2 months, and it has been a bestseller ever since. I had many favourite moments in this consistently charming book. Mildred breaking her broomstick 2 days into her first term and having to fly it thereafter with a giant bundle of sticky tape in the middle. Mildred accidentally turning spiteful teacher's pet Ethel into a small pink and grey pig. Mildred being given a tabby who hates flying on the broomstick even before it gets broken, and simply clings on for dear life underneath the twiggy end. The endearing illustrations of this by the author have incidentally left me with a lifelong yearning for a tabby kitten of my own, which, I note ruefully, has still yet to be fulfilled even though I am now 182 years old. And of course, the climactic triumphant enchanting by Mildred of Miss Cackle's evil sister and her coven, who are all turned into snakes after she uncovers their plot to take over the school. The whole thing fizzed with energy and invention and held me spellbound. The book's deeper attractions emerged over time. In the patient loyalty of Maud, the slightly older reader can see her ideal best friend. Mildred's combination of incompetence, resilience, and unapologetic eccentricity resonates and inspires. I have pretended to buy the umpteen sequels for nieces, nephews, and godchildren, and now my own child, over the years, but somehow they have all ended up in permanent residence on my shelves. The enchantment endures. Mildred was soon followed by a host of other companions. Ginny by Ted Greenwood, who took a dislike to her frizzy hair and cut it off in handfuls. I thrilled to the courageous depravity of such an action. I could never be so brave. But then I did have a mother who would cut off my own hands if I'd tried, so maybe it was all for the best. Catherine Storr's Lucy and Lucy Runs Away, which sparked a lifelong commitment to always having a running away fund and a running away bag. My first was a matter of fivepence pieces in a china toadstool and Victoria Plum satchel filled with panda pops stashed under the bed. Now it's three ices and an ASOS rucksack filled with cash, and I advise all women to keep a similar set of provisions handy. And then, head and shoulders above them all, yes, even those that doubled as survival manuals, there was Totty, The Story of a Doll's House, the first book to break my heart. Totty and Millie. Totty is a masterpiece. First published in 1947 as simply The Doll's House, Rumourgodden's story concerns a family of dolls and their owners, Emily and Charlotte, who are bequeathed their great-aunt's magnificent Victorian doll's house after she dies. Totty is the little farthing doll made of wood, as old as the house itself, and who used to live there years ago, but who now takes care of Mr. Plantagenet, a nervous doll after years spent with other far more careless owners. Birdie, a flighty celluloid doll upon whose noble sacrifice the book ultimately turns. Chubby boy doll Apple, and Dana the dog, in the two-shoebox house Emily and Charlotte have made. Within a story as beautifully and finely worked as the little tapestry chairs the dolls sit on in their lovely new home, acts of loyalty, betrayal, courage, vanity and folly play out somehow on a grand scale in their tiny rooms. The dolls' happiness is shattered by the arrival of one of the house's original residents. Unlike Totty, however, she is a very grand doll, made of kid and china and clothed in lace. She is called Marchpane. Marchpane is a heavy, sweet, sticky stuff like almond icing, explains Totty to Apple, who, like me, didn't understand the word. You very quickly have had enough of it. It was a good name for her. A new lock. A new key. Like the doors of a doll's house swinging open to reveal all the hidden rooms inside, this sentence opened up a new space in my mind. Cleverness of this sentence, the elusiveness, the indirection, not that I knew those words either at the time, took my breath away. I read on even more furiously than before, eager for the first time not just to find out what happened next, but to discover more of these brilliant, brilliant things that words and writers could do. Marchpane drives a wedge between Emily, who wants to turn the whole house over to the beautiful doll and make the others her servants, and the younger Charlotte, who struggles to articulate her sense of injustice until, spoiler alert, the tragedy of Birdie's death towards the end of the story reveals the truth. So you see, it's not about dolls at all. It's as neat a portrait of humanity as you could ever wish. Soon after Totty came another small figure, flesh and blood this time instead of wood, but with almost as unvarying a wardrobe, Millie Molly Mandy. Oh, Millie Molly Mandy. Until she came along, I didn't know that either the countryside or the past even existed. But by the end of the first story in Joyce Lancaster Brisley's collection of tales, published in 1928, about the little girl in the nice white cottage with the thatched roof, I was wholly possessed by the desire to live in both. So great was my need for fuel for this fantasy that, for the first time ever, Dad bought me the rest of the series, five whole books, count them, five whole books, at once. We were on holiday, which was already happiness enough, comprising, as it always did, 2 weeks with our beloved grandma in her flat in Preston, or home, as my mother, now 50 years a resident of the capital, still calls it. Eating chip butties under lowering skies and drinking deeply of the philosophy that has sustained Mangan's for generations. If we had some ham, we could have ham.